Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm talking with Brian Alexander today. He's a writer for Wired magazine. Brian has written many wonderful articles for Wired about the evolving biotechnologies. And his most recent book is Rapture, How Biotech Became the New Religion. And what's the subtitle again?
Well, the subtitle is How Biotech Became the New Religion, but then there's a little sort of sales title at the bottom on the cover. It says, A Raucous Tour of Cloning, Transhumanism, and the New Era of Immortality.
And it is a raucous tour. You lead it through quite a variety of different folks. You start with, I don't know if you know this or not, but the World Transhumanist Association just started an award for the best undergraduate student paper with a transhumanist theme every year, and we've named it the Haldane Award. So
I did know that. In fact, I had tried to get to the Transvision Conference.
Oh, good.
And I just wasn't able to make it. I noticed you were giving the Haldane Award there.
Yeah, the award went to a wonderful paper from a German student this year who wrote about the evolutionary significance of death, which pretty important. But at any rate, you talk about Haldane in the first chapter. The overall argument of your book is about the convergence of kind of cultural, fringe cultural transhumanist trends with bioscience. But Haldane was kind of prefigured all that, didn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, what a lot of people don't realize is that some of the things that the culture is talking about today was actually foreshadowed in the immediate aftermath of World War I, and even before World War I, with the rise of science fiction and writers like H.G. Wells and so on. So Haldane certainly picked up on that. He was sort of one of the earliest geneticists / microbiologists who realized that as we peered into the most basic elements of life, we were going to be able to manipulate them at some point.
And would you say that he was a transhumanist? I mean, certainly his writings about Daedalus and so forth, he talked about the eventual ectogenesis of being able to gestate a child inside a tank, and he talked about the life extension and so forth.
You know, I don't know if I would call him a transhumanist. I mean, maybe, but it's hard to... I mean, I think he probably believed in a fair amount of the kinds of things that transhumanists generally believe in, but I'm not sure he would accept the definition. It's one of the things that I actually have trouble with transhumanism, is the word even seems to denote a transformation, but I argue that we're always undergoing transformation, and we always have been undergoing transformation. So I'm not sure that he would put himself into a certain category that says I'm a transhumanist.
Well, that's an interesting point, because we argue also internally that the whole point of post-human, what does it mean to become a post-human if the people who end up there still see themselves in a continuity with humanity? You know, if they have green skin and four arms, and they still think that they're human because that's what their ancestry is. I mean, I don't know whether there is actually a kind of tactical significance or tactical utility in trying to argue this human point. We should just be talking about progress and medicine and so forth.
Well, and in fact, in my book, I do argue that there will be no such thing as a quote-unquote post-human future, because we'll still be human. I mean, we'll still consider ourselves as human as people were 10,000 years ago, and yet we aren't the same as we were 10,000 years ago. So I don't think the sort of post-human moment that so freaks out the people I call the bio-Luddites in the book, the people who are opposed to bioengineering, tinkering with the human condition, I don't think there'll ever be that moment. And in fact, I think as a tactical bit of rhetoric, it's a mistake, because I think that only serves to freak people out about biotechnology and new technologies, because they tend to internalize it and take it personally, as if they themselves will be usurped by some new species of creature. And in fact, we'll all be long dead, and those people will just consider themselves a continuation of the human line.
Well, not everybody wants to be long dead by the time it happens.
Right, I understand. I understand. I mean, that's I agree that a kind of practical immortality is in our future. I think I am somewhat less optimistic that you or I or anybody listening to the radio program will be around to enjoy it. I sort of hope I'm wrong, but I do tend to think it's further off in the future than many transhumanists believe it is.
Well, let's talk about the origins of the transhumanist movement per se, our contemporary transhumanist movement. You talk about Ettinger, this physics teacher in Michigan who started the cryonics movement, and he really was very instrumental in popularizing the idea of a post-human possibility.
Yeah, he was, and I think this really... I sometimes think that transhumanists perhaps are a little shy about saying this, but I don't think there's anything at all wrong with arguing that transhumanism really is partly an outgrowth of science fiction. I think that science fiction takes what is known about science in the present day and then speculates. And Ettinger was one of those people. He wasn't one of the more famous science fiction writers, but he was a science fiction writer and was very in the know about what was going on in science. And he, like many other science fiction writers, have the ability to look ahead. And he said, hey, wait a minute. If some of this stuff actually comes to fruition, there are going to be some rather dramatic changes in the human condition. And I think that's when he began to sort of proselytize the transhuman message. And I also credit fellow FM 2030 in the book with being another instrumental person who looked ahead based on what he knew about today.
Now, your book is basically about the convergence of the scientific community, the people on the cutting edge of nanotech and genetic engineering and so forth, with this message that was coming out of the cultural fringe about a transhuman possibility. And so a lot of your book is a focus on the life and career of William Hazeltine. It's Hazeltine, right?
Yeah, it's actually Hazeltine.
Hazeltine, okay.
Most people would say Hazeltine, but the Hazeltine family prefers Hazeltine as in razzle dazzle.
Okay. tell us where Hazeltine. Tell us where Hazeltine came from and what his significance is.
Hazeltine actually comes from a science family. His father, William R. Hazeltine, was one of the people who came out of World War. He was a physicist. Came out of World War II and went to work for the Navy at the China Lake Naval Research Center, making missiles and bombs and so on. Science was part of his growing up. At China Lake, it was a science community. And if you weren't a scientist there, then you were a military person, or you were an astronaut or a test pilot. It was a community that was focused on the future. Because his mother had some medical problems and he had some medical problems, he began to formulate a mission for his life, and that was that he was going to be one of those people who could prevent these things from happening. He went to the University of California, Berkeley, studied chemistry, then got his PhD at Harvard. His mentors were James Watson and Walter Gilbert, all both Nobel Prize winners, Alexander Rich, another Nobel Prize winner. He has been part of this second generation of molecular biologists following the first generation, which I would call sort of Francis Crick and James Watson and those sorts of people. Hazeltine follows in the second generation. He then went on to have his own lab at Harvard's Dana-Farber Cancer Center, did some seminal work on AIDS and HIV virus, and then probably best known in the larger world for becoming the CEO of probably the largest and best known genomics company, Human Genome Sciences. Hazeltine now talks about immortality, and he's not shy about it. Other scientists will also talk about immortality, but they are still pretty shy about it. Hazeltine has no such compunction and says, we will be immortal and we ought to be immortal.
And when was the connection made between what he was saying, what he realized he believed, and that there are other people out there who've been saying the same thing? I mean, you talk about growing set of cultural connections. I know, for instance, of Michael West, before I read your book, Michael West, the director of Advanced Cell Technology, has been in touch with and speaks at cryonics meetings where there are lots of transhumanists who are looking forward to him in reinventing cloning and stem cells and so forth. But when did William Hazeltine make this connection?
Well, I think that the connections really started, as I point out, with Haldane in the 20s. But then after World War II, we sort of took a step back because we had the atomic bomb, and it was a very dramatic illustration of what science could do in a destructive sense. And people got nervous about science a little bit after that. But within sort of the science tribe, people looked to this fellow, this physicist named Schrödinger, who's famous for this little corollary called Schrödinger's cat. Schrödinger wrote a little booklet called What is Life? And in the booklet, he says specifically that man can take control. And in fact, if this does work, that man can control his own biology, man can become God. This was an enormously influential piece of writing. It influenced many of the first generation of geneticists. So while they didn't run around repeating this very much, it was always really in the back of their minds that someday this could happen. Then you had the 70s where we really began to isolate genes. We began to sort of fool around a little bit with genes and cells and have control over basic biological systems, and that's where Hazeltine comes in. He was part of that generation that was manipulating bacteria and cells and focusing on human disease really for the first time to get at the roots of human disease. And he said, you know, if we can do this, there's no reason why we can't extend it out further and reach a logical endpoint of a kind of human immortality.
I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio, and we're speaking today with Brian Alexander, the author of Rapture, How Biotech Became the New Religion, and subtitled A Raucous Tour of Cloning, Transhumanism, and the New Era of Immortality. Brian's book chronicles the origins of the transhumanist movement and its gradual convergence with biotech pioneers like William Hazeltine, who gradually realized that biotech would make possible human enhancement and radical life extension. Brian, James Watson also fits in this picture. He was one of the decoders of DNA, and he's been saying things recently about how he thinks it's inevitable that we'll use genetic engineering to make people smarter and more attractive and fix the faults of the body, and upsetting a lot of people in the process.
That's right. You know, as I try to document in the book, the sort of spread of the transhumanist meme has been going on now for a little while. People who didn't want to have anything to do with it are now beginning to accept it. Like, gee, maybe we should interfere. Maybe we should take some control of our biology.
Tell us a little bit about Venter. Where does Craig Venter fit into this picture?
Well, it's the after the first wave of biotechnology, the founding of Genentech and Amgen and so on, biotech reached a sort of a trough where the funding window closed and biotech found itself in some trouble. Then in the 90s, with the rise of the Human Genome Project and genomics, which is where Hazeltine fits in, biotech became the rage again. Venter was able to use new machinery to isolate genes, to fish genetic information out of the genome, which is the genome, as many people may know, is a very confusing mass of sort of these letters, and not all the letters, in fact, a tiny minority of the letters are actually genes. Venter found a way to use these machines to get right at the genes. A venture capitalist decided that there was a business in getting at this information. And he teamed Hazeltine and Venter together. Venter was to be funded at a non-profit outfit called TIGER, the Institute for Genome Research, while the sort of twin brother of that was a for-profit corporation that became Human Genome Sciences. And the way the business worked was Human Genome Sciences would pay TIGER to come up with this information, and then Human Genome Sciences would market that information to pharmaceutical companies looking for drugs, and Human Genome Sciences would also make its own drugs based on that information.
So is Craig, do you think, has he picked up on the transhumanist meme as well, or is he saying things that are about human enhancement and the future possibilities?
He seems to stay away from things that you might consider transhumanism. You have to realize that when people, if you address that directly with many scientists, they'll back away from that. They don't necessarily want to be identified as transhumanists per se, even if they sort of believe in transhumanist-type possibilities. Venter tends to hew pretty closely to a very mainstream science rhetoric about making new drugs and new possibilities. He believes in the technology, but I wouldn't say that he considers himself in any way a transhumanist.
You know, it's really struck me about the reticence on the part of a lot of these scientists in a variety of fields. I was recently part of a think tanky exercise at a futurist institute, along with Greg Stock, and William French Anderson was one of the other scientists in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And there were about a dozen scientists in this group that we were in. And they were asked to project what the world was going to be like in the year 3000. And I said, well, by the year 3000, you know, we'll be beyond biology, we'll have, indefinite lifespans, and we'll be colonizing the stars, and, you know, typical transhumanist vision. And Stock was pretty close to what I was saying, but everybody else, all the practicing scientists said, oh, you know, the human brain's way too complicated for there to be any uploading, even in 1,000 years, and radical life extension's going to be way too complicated to have, even in 1,000 years. And I just couldn't believe it, you know, that people would think that in 1,000 years we wouldn't have cracked aging.
Well, I'm not convinced that many scientists truly believe that way. I think when they sort of sit down over a drink and talk among themselves, they may actually say some things that are different than the attitude that you encountered. You have to remember that scientists they're part of a tribe, and to gain acceptance and leadership in the tribe, you can't be too outrageous. You can't speculate too much. You've got to be able to prove everything you say. It also sort of breaks down sometimes on a generational level. Older scientists who have had more years of frustration tend to be more skeptical about possibilities. Younger scientists who are somewhat newer to the game tend to be more optimistic. They may very well adopt the attitude of the older scientists as time goes on. I don't know. But I was saying that I think that there is very little upside for a scientist like French Anderson, for example, to say that we're going to upload our brains in 1,000 years, there's going to be radical life extension 1,000 years from now. I mean, that gets him nowhere within science. What gets him somewhere within science is curing a child with gene therapy and proving that that can work, this very sort of near-term goal. That's how he advances in science. He doesn't gain anything by talking about the far future or radical life extension or anything that will scare anybody.
Mm. Well, let's talk about the scaremongers, the BioLuddites. You chronicle their rise. I'm of two minds about it. On the one hand, I think that there's a tactical reason to just emphasize how extreme they are, because very few people really want to embrace death and suffering the way that they argue that we should. The vast majority of the public are going to be with transhumanists when push comes to shove about whether we should have X, Y, and Z technology and access to them. On the other hand, they do represent a very common, especially in the United States, religious impulse to eschew playing God and so forth. So I don't know whether to, you know, laugh or to cry about the BioLuddites and the fact that Leon Cass is considered the dean of American bioethics by George Bush.
Well, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because within the bioethics community, He's not necessarily considered a dean of anything. You know, I guess I'm of two minds like you are about it. It's interesting. When I talk to people who don't really know that much about biotechnology or biology, and I just sort of pose questions to them about genetic engineering and so on, they are often very afraid. Then I'll bring it into a more specific example about them personally or someone they love, and I'll talk about cancer or a genetic disease, say cystic fibrosis or any other sort of genetic disease, and then the rhetoric changes. I don't think that I think the global message of the bio-Luddites, which is be afraid, be very afraid, has a good deal of currency and a receptive audience. If you sort of bring it down to the level of the individual human being and what they are concerned about, they would say, well, no, I don't want to suffer. If I don't have to suffer, why should I suffer? Just look at the acceptance of Viagra, for example. I mean, you could make a pretty good argument that as men get older, it's perfectly natural for them to have some level of impotence. And yet Viagra was the biggest blockbuster drug of all time. People accepted it. People want themselves to be a little happier and healthier and live a little longer. But if you bring it out to the overall sort of worldwide global impact, then they'll start to talk about overpopulation, and it's just kind of creepy and so on. So I think in the long term, the bio-Luddite message will ultimately fail because of economics. People will buy things they perceive will make their lives better.
The post-human goalpost, the line of hubris, it continues to move. It's a moving goalpost.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, if you were to be in 1900, and talk about computers and an internet and some of the biology that goes on today, like IVF. I mean, when Haldane speculated about IVF, it caused a bit of an uproar. There were letters to the editor in the London Times, and he created a lot of controversy, much to the consternation of his own family at the time. Now, IVF, despite the opposition of Leon Cass and the bio-Luddites, IVF is very accepted. Thousands and thousands of babies have been born with IVF.
Put in the context for us the National Science Foundation's Nano Bio Info Cogno initiative, which some friends actually of the transhumanist movement have been helping to create. But I think that for the bio-Luddites, this was a real wake-up call that when 150 people who had no association with the transhumanist movement, who never used the term at all in their writings, who never referred to FM 2030 or anybody like that, got together to talk about what the ramifications of nano, info, bio, and cognitive science were going to be, within the next 20 or 30 years, they said some pretty amazing things.
They did say some amazing things, and even though I've been sort of following loosely transhumanism and life extension for 10 years or so now, I was surprised that a sort of quasi-governmental body like the National Science Foundation would issue a report like that. The report didn't gain a lot of publicity at the time, but I thought it was somewhat earth-shaking such a mainstream organization would issue a report like that, which was extremely optimistic about the impact of sort of the digital sciences as well as the biological sciences. And I suspect that the President's Council on Bioethics, that's headed by Leon Cass, and I would argue is fairly heavily weighted with a bio-Luddite game plan, I think that probably did alarm them for the very reason that it surprised me. This was not a tiny transhumanist get-together. This was a body funded by the government announcing what amounted to a transhumanist future.
Now, you have some critical ideas at the end of your book about the ways that transhumanists should rethink the message, rethink the strategy. Just to run us through that argument again, I mean, basically, we talked about the notion that scaring people by talking about the obsolescence of the human race isn't such a good idea.
No, because we look, you're attacking ourselves if you do that. People don't, when you say, you know, we shouldn't be human anymore, and you use a word or pronoun like we, that's you and me. And yet we are human, and I think most people rather like being human as long as, you know, they've got their health and so on. I think there's a lot of joy in being human. I argue that somebody like Bill Hazeltine is right. Bill Hazeltine does not argue that there is going to be such a thing as a quote-unquote post-human future. And I think post-human has become, well, in fact, I know it's become a very juicy word for the bio-Luddites. Francis Fukuyama, for example, has a book out about our post-human future, which is a scary scenario for why we will all be obsolete. And that's you and me living today. I don't think there will ever be such a thing as a post-human future, because the people who live in the future will just consider themselves the descendants of us. Whatever the technology delivers to them, whether it's bio or techno or digital or whatever it may be, they will just be a continuation of the human species. They may be different from us, they may be smarter or taller or live 500 years or whatever the case may be. They're just going to consider themselves human, and they will still be on the human quest. You know, I argue that there has always been a human quest. There will never be a finish line, and they will just be continuing down that quest. And that, I think, is what defines a human being, a part of the human species. It's not our genes. It's not necessarily even the way we look. It's that we are on a quest, and we will always continue on that quest.
I just interviewed Marshall Brain, who is the founder of the How Stuff Works website and series of books, and his latest epiphany is about how human beings may become obsolescent because of robotics. And it may be that the way things work out, that we come to see our replacement and the challenge to our future from robotics is far more severe than any challenges from biotechnology or human enhancement, and that it's really a race between the people who consider themselves human no matter how enhanced they get and the non-human, non-organic forms of life.
Yeah, I discussed slightly in the book this play from the 1920s called RUR, which stands for Rossum's Universal Robots. It was the first use of the term robots, and their robots do indeed take over the Earth. That's never bothered me, or scared me, I should say. I just don't think that's ever going to happen. I tend to not be a sort of person who believes that we are going to be uploaded. I think it might be possible someday, but I think people like their bodies. I think people like the way we are. We just want to be better at what we are, and I don't think that we're going to be replaced by robots or computers or anything ever. I always believe that there is going to be a corporeal human future in a biological sense.
I've been speaking with Brian Alexander. He's a writer for Wired magazine, and his latest book is Rapture, How Biotech Became the New Religion. It chronicles the convergence of the transhumanist subculture with contemporary scientific reality, and it's available online and at your local bookstore. Thanks so much for joining us, Brian.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, James.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.